You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. With me is co-host psychologist, Dr. Melody Fox.
And each week, we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future.
We will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually healthy.
With both of us having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, we have been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and some truly entertaining and innovative authors who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us.
And we will continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family.
And Alan, before we get to our guests, I would like to share with our listeners that you, Alan, happen to be on Les Brown's talk show on KFWB 980, which is here in Los Angeles, and it's an affiliate of CBS. Actually, I worked for them years and years ago. But anyway, it was a wonderful interview, and I really enjoyed hearing you share about what you do and why you do it. I know we've talked about it before, and I especially liked how you shared how you had an incident which you were going into the family business, but then you had hurt yourself. You couldn't continue with that, and you had to do some soul searching at a very early age to figure out what's my passion, what is it I really want to do, and how you fell into doing what you're doing as a detective, rescuing teens, transporting teens, and everything that you do. So it was really fabulous, and I urge everybody to go to our website, actually, at www.answers4thefamilyblog.com, and you can link on to Les Brown's interview with Alan. It was fantastic. Another part is I really enjoyed how you discussed how you use what you call the magic wand. And I know you explained that in the interview. I don't know if you want to take a moment here or not, but it's a lot like asking our clients a miracle question or something about, and it really gives you and your staff a chance to connect with the teens and have them know they're being heard, they're being listened to, their dreams are important, their thoughts, their ideas, how they want to see their life and have it unfold is really amazing. And that's part of why you're good at what you do.
Well, Melody, thank you for bringing it up. And in regards to the first part, and I think what we were really touching on was the fact that we're all going to have things that are going to change in our life, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's all in how you look at it. And so, again, myself having an injury and being laid up for about 6 weeks and being a very active person, that was pretty devastating at 19 years old. Mm-hmm. But, you know, rather than look at it and say, okay, the doctor said I'm not going to walk, you know, by the time I'm 30, I looked at it differently, and I looked at it as, what is it do I really want to do? And that was where I decided. I said, okay, I'm going to pursue something that I want to do that I know that I will enjoy, mm-hmm. and taking into consideration the fact that I may not be able to be as physically capable, I had to go with something where I knew I'd be using my mind more than my back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, extraordinary story, and I think that's what makes a difference with some people, being able to follow their dream, follow their bliss, find what they love, and to really do that, find their passion. I know for me it was very similar, too, about being laid up after some foot surgeries and trying to figure out, what is it I really want to do? Do I want to continue working with agencies, or do I want the freedom to work with whomever I want to work with and really help them? And that's where my passion went to. And to be able to follow your dream is truly beneficial. I think my grandfather used to tell me, do what you love and the money will come. If it doesn't, you've had a wonderful life anyway.
Absolutely. Very wise words by your grandfather.
Yeah.
And I think, and to touch on the second part you mentioned, which is the magic wand.
Yes.
And it really has to do with communicating with people on the level that they want to communicate on. And in dealing with some young people, if they are in a juvenile hall setting or they're in a psychiatric hospital, to be able to start out by asking them, if I had a magic wand and I could wave it right now, what would you want me to do? Mm-hmm. And by starting the question, they're able to look inward and say, what do I really want? Because so many times they're used to being approached by somebody who is presenting a tag on them that you are this, and because of this, I have to do something either to help you or to do something. And And I want to make sure that they understand that my first and foremost goal is to communicate with them and find out what they want.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And if they could vocalize and say what they want and get an idea, then it puts it out there in the universe and allows other people to help them to create that and get that support network going and that support group. And I know we could talk about this forever, so and we have a guest on standby.
Well, yes, but I want you to know I couldn't have said it any better. What you just said right now about getting out in the universe, I couldn't have said it better. That's a great way to put it, and I hope that the kids see it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm excited because our guest today is Sam Keen. He has published work in New York Times Magazine, Mental Floss, Slate, and New Scientist. And in 2009, he was runner-up for the National Association of Science Writers Award for Best Science Writer Under the Age of 30. So we're going to be talking to someone who has a passion for what he does. And Sam...
and absolutely. And, you know, he was also featured on National Public Radio's All Things Considered and On Point. Now, our topic today is going to be a little bit different. It's about madness, it's about love, and it's about the history of the world as told by the periodic table of elements. This and more from his new book, The Disappearing Spoon, which is his first book and a New York Times bestseller. Sam, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Oh, we are thrilled that you're here. Now, you're talking about the periodic table. I look at that thing, and I'm just so confused. I was that way in school. And, you know, what got you first interested in the periodic table? It's such an unusual thing to be interested by. And what age were you at that time?
I was fairly young. It was about in third grade or so. And the backstory is that I was kind of unlucky that year. And I came down with strep throat something like a dozen times that year. And, of course, I had to stay home from school every single time. And my mother would come in to take my temperature, and she would put one of those old-fashioned mercury thermometers beneath my tongue. Mm-hmm. And I admit I was a little clumsy as a kid and a little prone to talking to myself, too. So when they were under my tongue, not infrequently, they ended up dropping on our floor, and they would break on the hardwood floor. But I was always kind of secretly excited when that happened because I loved watching the mercury sort of scatter across our floor. It was like these little liquid ball bearings on our floor. And my mother was actually very cool about the whole thing. She never panicked. She never evacuated the house or anything like that. She actually got down on her hands and knees with a toothpick, and she would brush the little spheres of mercury together. And I just loved watching that. It was such a fascinating substance. And that's really how I got interested in the periodic table, was through mercury. And then the more I looked at mercury and the more I found out about it in later years, I realized it really had a very long and rich history. It was very important in science for a very long time. But even as far back as classical times, they were talking about and dealing with mercury. Alchemists loved mercury. They were bringing whole galleons of mercury over to the New World from Europe to try to help with gold mining and everything. So it just had such a rich history that it really not only got me interested in the periodic table and the elements, but it made me see that there's so much more to the periodic table than what, you know, you might remember from a high school chemistry class.
Well, and Sam, and I noticed in your book that mercury also has an unusual connection to Lewis and Clark, doesn't it?
It does. That was one of the stories that really grabbed me. I'm from the Midwest. I'm from South Dakota. And so we always had a very long Lewis and Clark section in our local history classes. But they had an ally, Lewis and Clark did, who helped them when they were preparing for their trip across the wilderness. His name was Dr. Benjamin Rush. He was one of the founding fathers. He lived in Philadelphia. And he was actually a very brave doctor, too. There was a yellow fever epidemic in Philadelphia in, I think, the 1790s or so. And he was very brave. When other doctors were running away for the countryside, he stayed back and he helped a lot of people. Unfortunately, his pet treatment for almost anything was this sort of mercury chloride sludge that he would feed people, often to the point where their hair would start to fall out or their teeth would get loose and fall out. The idea at the time in medicine was that you had to sort of fight fire with fire, that if you had an ugly disease, you had to give somebody something that would that was sort of equally harsh to get it out of them. But the mercury medicine he would prescribe had a side effect, and that's where Lewis and Clark came in. Dr. Rush ended up patenting what are called Dr. Rush's bilious pills. They reach about four times the size of an aspirin, very large pills, and there's really no delicate way to put it. They were extremely powerful laxatives. Mm. They called them thunderclappers, and the idea was for Lewis and Clark that if they were out in the wilderness and, you know, they ate a plant that they shouldn't have or they drank some water that didn't agree with them, they could take one of the bilious pills and it would basically flush their system out. It would get rid of everything harmful inside them. And it worked very well. So well, in fact, that archaeologists today can actually pinpoint a few places where they know Lewis and Clark must have stayed, because the level of mercury in the soil is just too high for it to have been natural. So It's one of the ways you can see the elements sort of bridging the long gaps from history.
Well, it's almost like chemotherapy at the earliest stages.
It's a very, very harsh harsh treatment. There's thankfully a little bit more science behind chemotherapy than the mercury, but it is sort of the same idea. You want to do damage to the thing that's damaging you.
Right.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that our archaeologists in tracking Lewis and Clark were doing it by way of their porta-potties?
there are a few places where they know that they must have been there, or at least dug a latrine, because there, again, is mercury in the soil, too much for it to have been natural. So it was kind of an unusual side effect of the whole bilious pills thing.
Well, it sounds like you have a real, you know, flair for this and an interest in history as well. So, you know, what was your whole purpose of writing this particular book? What was your mission here?
One of the big things I wanted to do was to show people that there's a lot more to the periodic table than just the science on it. It really intersects with so many different areas of life, with art, with war, with economics, history, poison, so many different things. You know, it's one thing, it's maybe the only thing in some cases that everyone remembers from high school chemistry class. But we never got to talk about, at least in my class, whole swaths of the periodic table. There were so many elements that were just a mystery, mm-hmm. and I wanted to explore those unexplored parts. And I found out there were a lot of fantastic stories out there about elements that people have never heard of. And there were also some really great stories, too, about elements that people thought or think they know very well, but that ended up having some unusual backstories to them.
Well, tell us something surprising about one of those familiar elements.
Sure. One of the elements, one of my favorite stories in the book, actually, has to do with the element aluminum. And it's an element that, of course, everyone knows today. It's in pop cans and Little League baseball bats, everything like that. But for a long time, aluminum was actually the most precious metal on Earth. It was worth far more than silver was. It was worth far more than gold, even. And the reason why is that even though aluminum is very common in the Earth's crust, it's the most common metal in the Earth's crust, in fact, whenever you find aluminum, it's always very tightly bonded to another element, usually oxygen or something like that. So you never find pure samples of aluminum in nature like you do with other elements. And so when scientists in the early 1800s finally figured out that there was this metal out there called aluminum and started to get very small samples of it, it was considered kind of a miracle metal. It was, unlike gold or silver, it was very light, but it was also very strong and very attractive, too. And it became such a phenomenon that it turned into sort of a status symbol for emperors and kings and presidents to get their hands on aluminum and to kind of show off a little bit. The French actually had these Fort Knox-like bars of aluminum that they would display next to their crown jewels to sort of overawe people. And, the Emperor Napoleon III had this prized set of aluminum cutlery that he reserved for his most favored guests at banquets. Mm-hmm. And the lesser nobility were reduced to eating with gold knives and forks.
Well, even the United States
got into the act a little bit. The Washington Monument on the National Mall, that tall white obelisk, at the very tip of it, there is a 6-inch pyramid of aluminum. And it went up there in the 1880s for two reasons. One was, of course, they needed a lightning rod, so they needed some sort of metal up there. But they chose aluminum because we were kind of an up-and-coming power at the time, and we were actually bragging a little bit and saying that we were so powerful and had so many resources, we could actually afford to put aluminum on our public monuments of all things. And, you know, after these wild stories about emperors and presidents and things, the aluminum market, of course, crashed very, very quickly. People figured out how to get it produced on an industrial scale, and it became sort of the passé metal that we know nowadays. Mm-hmm. But I really love the story because I think it goes to show how the elements, their fortunes sort of change over time. And what was really a precious metal for one generation, by even the next generation, you know, isn't worth much at all.
Wow. I'm really curious, how did they come up with the names of these elements?
Well, the scientists actually, if you discover an element, you get to name that element. And it's actually a very big honor for you to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In the olden times, back when, you know, people were learning Greek and Latin in school every day, they would name them after mythological characters or other things like that. Then for a while it became sort of popular to name them after your home country or your home city or something like that. There's an element called californium, named obviously after California.
Wow.
Nowadays, kind of the big trend is to name elements after famous scientists. So there's an element called einsteinium after Albert Einstein, or mendelevium after Dmitri Mendeleev, sort of the father of the periodic table.
Wow.
So those trends kind of change over time, but it's basically up to the scientist to pick an element he thinks, we either honor someone he really likes or is just something he thinks sounds fun.
Yeah, I was just always curious, so thank you for explaining that to me.
No, no problem. No, it is one of the mysterious things that you just don't, when you just see it hanging there day after day, you never really, you know, you don't get into that enough. But there's some fun stories out there about those kind of things.
Oh, sure. Now, in writing the book, was it geared more towards scientists or for non-scientists or a little bit of both, or to get, you know, people excited about the table, the periodic table, or...
Yeah, I think both is what I was aiming at. You certainly don't need, a long scientific background to enjoy the disappearing spoon. There's no specialized knowledge required or anything about that, or like that. And I think you'll actually learn some science throughout it. But I always was trying to make sure that the science never really, you know, tripped up the narrative. I really wanted to focus on the stories here. And that's why I think both scientists and non-scientists have really... responded to the book. The science people sort of get to hear stories that they'd never imagined. And the people who didn't have a science background, they also get the stories, but they get to learn a little bit about the periodic table as well. So I think there's something for both people.
Wow.
Now, Sam, I noticed in your book that you mentioned the term murder. And I assume you were talking about poisonous elements like lead or arsenic. Are those the most deadly elements on the table?
Those are pretty deadly. What's considered the most deadly element is actually one called thallium, which is element 81. It's down there in sort of what I call poisoner's corridor, which is right by lead and mercury, arsenic, things like that. But thallium really does a lot of damage just on a very small scale. It doesn't take much thallium to, what it does is it goes in your body, it actually starts unstitching some of the important proteins that you need. So it does a lot, kind of an outsized amount of damage for how much gets into you. And it's actually been sort of a favorite for some different serial killers. They really enjoyed using it for whatever reason, probably because, again, it's very small doses, and it's also very hard to trace thallium. So you don't, it won't necessarily get traced back to you. But even in, you know, later times, thallium still pops up every now and then. There was a Russian war depot a few years back. It was sort of left over from the Cold War. And there was, I believe they were in the Air Force, but either Air Force, Army, something like that. They were exposed to this thallium, and they ended up dying from it. In Iraq, a couple years ago, I think it was, someone actually poisoned a birthday cake for a small child's party and ended up getting everyone there sick, and I believe caused some fatalities, too. It was something that Saddam Hussein liked to use. But, you know, even the United States has sort of considered thallium at various points. There was a plot at one point to go after Fidel Castro with thallium, and the plan was that they were going to, I guess, powder his socks with it in some way, just get it into his socks, and then he would have absorbed it through his skin, and it would get distributed in his bloodstream. And the reason they did that is, again, it's hard to trace, but they also knew that it would make his hair fall out. It would make his beard fall out. And they kind of wanted to humiliate him at the same time that they were going to poison him. So this element really has kind of an unusual history as a poison. It's not one of the everyday elements that gets a lot of people, but it's certainly one of the deadlier ones.
Well, how hard is it to get these elements? I mean, you've got mercury in thermometers, you've got, you know, plants that have arsenic, and you've got lead here and there. I mean, and you're talking about thallium and all these conspiracies, it sounds like, to use it to hurt other people. And, you know, how easy is it to get your hands on it?
Well, most of these elements that I was just talking about and the ones you mentioned are thankfully fairly rare. Pretty heavy elements. Thallium, again, was number 81. And as a general rule, the farther down you get on the periodic table, the rarer the elements are. And by the time you get down into the 80s, they are very, very rare. It's hard to find big samples of those elements. So they're not something that's easily accessible or that's around a lot. So,
well, good. I can breathe better.
They are a little hard to find.
Well, earlier you mentioned how the periodic table is connected to art. And so what are the artistic connections to the elements? Although I think about paint.
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I was saying, but I was just thought about paint, maybe because you heard of lead paint in the past. Is that one of them, or are there other areas?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There are certain elements that, for whatever reason, are very, very bright. You can combine them with other elements, and they just make lots of interesting and very nice colors. Lead is one of the good ones. It comes in lead-based paints and things like that. Some other ones that do that are, there's an element called cadmium, which is very famous for making a nice bright red color. And it's the element that Henri Matisse in particular relied on. He made these gorgeous, gorgeous, vibrant red canvases. And when you're looking at those, what you're looking at in large part is the cadmium on there. That's sort of that bright, pulsating red. And he probably wouldn't have been the same artist or even necessarily such a great artist if he hadn't had those kind of pigments available to him. They were very new at the time. Scientists were just sort of figuring out what to do with all of these elements they discovered. And they figured out one of the best ways to use them was in cadmium. Arsenic is another one that also makes for very vibrant colors, especially a very vibrant green color. It was a favorite of Monet. He liked to use it in his waterscapes, especially with the lilies and things. When you see those types of paintings, you're probably looking at arsenic. And unfortunately, arsenic has also been used in the past in things like wallpaper or, you know, even dresses, things like that. It was before people sort of realized that arsenic was deadly. But there are still, apparently, I've heard, old houses or something today where you can still find, you know, some arsenic wallpaper, sort of like you just find lead paint in very old houses, things like that.
And you mentioned there are poisonous elements. I mean, how do they affect people? Or did they affect
the artists? They can do it in a lot of ways. Cadmium, the element I just mentioned a minute ago, affects people by mimicking zinc in the body. And also, I believe it mimics calcium, too. And that's how it gets into people's bones. It does a lot of damage in bones. There's a famous cadmium poisoning case, actually, in Japan in the 1930s and 40s, and it evicted so much of the calcium from people's bones that they were, you know, breaking hips very easily, falling down, and things like that. One doctor reportedly even broke a woman's wrist just by taking her pulse. That is how weak her bones had gotten. So they can do things in various ways, but usually what happens is that it either unstitches some important proteins or it kind of evicts minerals and other things that people need in their body and ends up replacing them.
Yeah, we are talking with Sam Keen. His book is The Disappearing Spoon. It is a New York Times bestseller. We will be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. Again, we are talking to Sam Keen. His book is The Disappearing Spoon.
And it's really interesting because it's so, I mean, like I said, the periodic table, I look at that, my eyes cross going, huh? I kind of remember that. I kind of wanted to forget it. But it's so fascinating, Sam, when you break it down for us. And I think it makes it more interesting. And I think it could really get kids more interested in science and all that. But I was wondering, you know, what do you think our families can learn from reading your book?
I think there are a couple of things. Again, as you said, I've had a lot of teachers get in touch with me, and, you know, they find that the book is a good entry point for students. You know, obviously it's not going to replace a science class, but it can get people interested in it and get them to, just get them kind of excited about the idea of science and learning about the periodic table and sort of instill a sense of wonder or curiosity and make them want to know a little bit more about it. But I also think that people can actually learn a lot more science than you might expect just by hearing stories and by learning some different stories. I just think that's the way the human mind works. We remember information best when it's presented to us in a story form. And that's really what I concentrated on in the book, was getting a lot of those stories together and sort of using science as a springboard to get at using the stories as a springboard to get at the science and try to combine the two. So I think it, again, would be a good way to get kids interested in it or to sort of deepen an appreciation if they already are sort of scientifically inclined.
And Sam, what age do you think parents should introduce the elements to their children?
I think we might have started learning about it, you know, probably in school in like third or fourth grade, something like that. I think you can do it that young, at that age, and just sort of introduce the basic idea of the periodic table, like why it's shaped the way it is and what an element is and things like that. I think that's something that a kid could probably start to get his teeth into at that point. So I think you can do some things with children at fairly young ages. And then, of course, you can, you know, pour vinegar on baking soda and make a volcano and things like that. You know,
do
some experiments that'll sort of intrigue them, make their eyes pop open wide. So there's different things you can do, I think.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, we have some listener questions, which we do appreciate people emailing in their questions for us for upcoming guests. And one of the questions goes along with what you were just talking about. It says, science has always been such a fascinating subject for me and my husband. I had hoped that our passion would have rubbed off on our son, who is now 14, but he has little or no interest in the subject or the topic at all. Is your book one that would spark his interest, or can you suggest a way that we could spur this on? What do you think, Sam?
I think the things I mentioned before, again, would be good for that kind of thing. Just getting stories and trying to teach them that it's not all just equations and having to memorize the periodic table, things like that. There are actually a lot of, tales out there, and there's a lot of passion that went into making the table, rivalries, people getting very upset with each other, things like that. There's a lot of human interest stuff in the periodic table as well. And then, you know, there are always sort of the practical demonstrations. Some people don't like necessarily sitting there and learning like that. They kind of want to be up and doing things. So I think there are different ways to try to spark a love of science if someone's struggling a little bit.
And kind of what I love about this is that I think it would make it easier for people to remember the periodic table, having the stories behind it, being able to connect with it in a different way because everybody learns differently. And you know, you talk about stories. I'm just curious, what is one of the funniest stories about one of the elements that you have or do you have?
One of the funniest stories.
Yeah, I like funny.
Funny stories. Okay. I can tell you the title, what the title means of the book. I guess it will depend on your sense of humor whether you find this sort of thing funny, but we can attempt it.
Okay.
The Disappearing Spoon comes from a story based on one element on the table. Element is called gallium. It's element 31. And gallium sits right below aluminum on the periodic table. And sort of the organizing principle of the periodic table is that elements that are in the same column, like gallium and aluminum, have very similar properties. They look alike. So if you had a chunk of one and a chunk of the other one sitting in front of you, you probably wouldn't be able to tell them apart, except gallium has one unusual property in that it melts at about 85 degrees Fahrenheit. So even if you put it in the palm of your hand, it will start to soften up. It will start to melt in your hand. And the title, The Disappearing Spoon, comes in because it's sort of a classic nerdy science prank to make a spoon out of gallium metal and then to serve it to somebody with hot coffee or tea or something like that. And they, of course, think they're just getting an aluminum spoon. But when they put the head of it in their tea and start to stir it around, it disappears on them. So, well, hence the disappearing spoon.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it safe to drink?
That's what everyone always wants to know immediately is could they drink it? I don't think there's really any danger being around gallium itself. It's not acutely toxic, not something you have to worry about. But I don't think you would want to drink the sort of the liquid slug on the bottom of the tee. Might not feel so good going down.
Oh, okay. Just curious.
All right. Well, going along that same lines, what's the most bizarre story about one of the elements?
Most bizarre story? Let me think a little. Well, one story that really, I guess, sticks in my mind is something a little bizarre, just because I wouldn't have expected it going in, was a story about some Russian scientists, actually Soviet scientists at the time, and some American scientists in the 1960s and 70s. And both of those scientists at the time, groups of scientists, were trying to create new elements on the periodic table. They were trying to make heavier and heavier elements. And they actually got into quite a nasty spat about these elements, about who had discovered them first. And we talked a little bit earlier about if you discover an element, you get the right to name it. Well, these people, both sides, each wanted the rights to name these elements. And again, the fight turned very, very nasty. And in some ways, the periodic table actually became sort of a new theater for the Cold War. They were sort of waging the Cold War by proxy with the periodic table. And this fight between the different groups went all through the 1960s, it went all through the 1970s, all through the 1980s, and then the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 90s. But this fight was still going on between these groups of scientists 30 or even 40 years later. That is how, you know, interested and passionate they were about the periodic table. And that always stuck with me as a little bizarre because, you know, it's not, people usually don't get too worked up over the periodic table. It's not something people remember with a lot of fervor and passion. But this was so important to these scientists that they spend the better part of their lives fighting over who would get credit for naming these elements. So that's one that always kind of stuck out in my mind.
But why do scientists care so much about naming them? I mean, what difference does it make if we're all in it together and, you know, why not share the glory, so to speak?
Well, that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it, well, there are two ways to look at it. One is that, you know, scientists are human beings, and for all of the, they look very objective when they're writing their papers. They come off very impressive, like teaching something. But when it actually gets down to it, they're human beings. They have the same passions and petty jealousies that other people do. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about science history, and something that I certainly tried to get into as much as possible because I'm fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. The other reason why I think the periodic table itself draws so much passion is that, you know, if you discover a new, you know, species of salamander or a crater on Mars or something like that, you get the right to name that thing. And, you know, that's great for you. But if you get the right to name an element, that is going to be on every periodic table in every single classroom in the entire world from now until basically the end of our civilization. There's going to be millions of people looking at that every single year. It's about the most high-profile thing you can get in science. And I think that's why people really get worked up about that, because they know that there is a fair amount at stake there.
Well, and it sounds like what you're saying is it's part of their legacy. And to a scientist, if they've dedicated their life to that, they would want that. I mean, again, if somebody's a baseball player, they'd like to have the record for the most home runs. But if you're a scientist, the legacy by having something named after you is probably as equally important to them.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you get. That's what that's your legacy, is the names of the elements on the periodic table. So you don't want someone, you know, from another country across the ocean getting the rights, what you worth a decade or more to earn.
Yeah. I want to go back to a little bit of the stories that you had in your book, but what was it about iodine that Gandhi didn't care for?
Oh, that goes back to when Gandhi was first getting involved in protests against the British. The British were ruling India at the time, of course. This was in the 1930s. And one of the things the British did was they leveled a tax on salt. Salt was one of the few things that a poor person in India could sell on their own. All they had to do was gather a basin of seawater, let it evaporate, then they'd have a little bit of salt to sell. But the British were putting a high tax on salt, and many people consider that very unfair. They were very against it. Mm-hmm. But they weren't organized enough to do anything about it. So Gandhi organized what became known as the Salt March, and he gathered thousands upon thousands of people. He finally organized them and got the British to repeal their salt tax. So it was a very powerful moment in the independence movement in India. So you fast forward many years later to the 80s and 90s. India is, of course, independent at this point. But doctors at this point in India are realizing that there are a lot of birth defects in India because there isn't enough iodine in the salt. Iodine is an essential nutrient. We don't need much of it, but you do need a little bit of it. Mm-hmm. And again, if you don't have it, it causes birth defects. So the doctors in India wanted to add iodine to the salt and to prevent these birth defects from happening. Unfortunately, there was kind of an idea in India, it was sort of a holdover from Gandhi's time, that people, especially Western doctors, were interfering with their salt industry again. And they didn't like it. They really wanted to keep the iodine out of their salt, basically because they saw it as interference in their own affairs. And the idea of Gandhi became a very, very powerful idea. And some people even began to claim that Gandhi would not have wanted the iodine in their salt. Now, of course, Gandhi wouldn't have known about that. But in people's minds, it just became sort of a legend that Gandhi would have stood against the iodine in the salt. And it's gone back and forth over the past decade or so. I think the last I heard, they do have to put iodine in their salt now, but it could easily tip the other way again.
Hmm. Well, and I noticed something else that you had mentioned in the book, and it had to do with radium. Now, how did radium nearly ruin Marie Curie's reputation?
Radium was an element that was discovered by Marie Curie, and radium really sort of took off in the public's imagination for a few reasons. One, it had been discovered by Marie Curie and her husband, Pierre, and they were very famous scientists, so it had a connection with them. Radium was also the most radioactive element that anyone had seen at that point. People didn't really understand radioactivity at the time in the very early 1900s. And so it was considered sort of this mysterious new force in the world. And actually people, so it became sort of fashionable to have radioactive goods and things like that. Radium glows in the dark. That's the third reason why it was very popular. It glows in the dark. It's sort of that bluish-green glow-in-the-dark that you see sometimes. And people started putting it in consumer goods. They're painting watch dials with it, things like that. You could see them in the dark. Other people started lining crocks with radium, water crocks with radium. And then you would soak water in there, and it, overnight, the water would become infused with radium. And then you would invite your friends over, and you would drink these sort of radioactive cocktails. So it really captured the public imagination, the idea of radioactivity, and Marie Curie was sort of propelled to fame with that. But to get back to your question about why it ruined her reputation almost, was that she was showing some other scientists the properties of radium one day. She had a small vial of it. And one of the things that she wanted to show them was that it glowed in the dark. It had a very alluring color. Mm-hmm. So she took some of her fellow scientists. So she was at one of their houses. She took them, and she went with them into a closet together. And this was not something that a proper lady did at that time, was going to a closet with strange men. And the wife of one of the men got very upset that Marie seemed to be taking a very long time in there showing them about the mysteries of radium. And she knocked on the door very curtly and got her out of there. And that sort of damaged her reputation a little bit, that she was doing things like pulling strange men into closets just to show off this element.
Well, I'm just curious, are there still elements out there to be discovered? I mean, there's so many unknowns out there in the world and the universe. I mean, are there more?
Well, sort of. It kind of depends on how you define it. Scientists aren't going out anymore like in the olden days and getting their fingernails dirty and finding elements in nature. When they make a new element nowadays, you actually have to create it in a lab. The basic idea is that you have a target of something, and you have a beam of another element, and you shoot it at the target very fast and hope that something sticks together. That's the basic idea. But again, scientists are making these in the lab, and it can take a decade or more work to get one of these elements out. And at the end of that decade of work, you might have, you know, just 5 or 6 atoms of that element, an incredibly tiny amount of that element. And the moral of this is that it's getting very hard to create new elements nowadays. Scientists have 118 of them. The latest one was added about 1.5 years ago now. But it's an open question of how far they will be able to go. And, you know, there's a good chance that at some point the elements that they're making are so heavy and so fragile that they will just fall apart instantly. And after that point, the periodic table might have a period put on it. It might be over.
Wow.
Well, Sam, we've got another question coming in from a listener, and this one reads,
sure.
Does your book touch on the topic of alchemy? I am hearing so much about this these days and was wondering what your thoughts were about its validity.
Yeah, the book does talk about alchemy in connection with a few specific elements. Mercury, again, antimony was another one. It's really a rich and sort of fun history. And it's kind of unusual in that alchemy, you know, not too long ago was seen as sort of this really silly pseudoscience that people wasted incredible amounts of time with, and then sort of the noble scientists came after them and vanquished their ideas. But I think there's really been a reversal in a lot of historians' thinking. They now realize that the alchemists actually did a lot of very good scientific work on their own. They didn't, of course, have the understanding we have nowadays, but we can't really blame them for that. And a lot of the work they did was very smart, very sophisticated work. And they, instead of being sort of vanquished by the later scientists, they in many ways paved the way for them and prepared the way for those scientists. And one thing I think that really has changed people's minds about alchemy is the fact that Isaac Newton actually spent the large majority of his career working in alchemy. He, of course, invented calculus. He invented the theory of gravity. He has his laws of motion. Very, very famous scientist for those things. But he sort of just dashed those things off so he could get back to alchemy. He spent 3 decades or more working on alchemy. And it was kind of an embarrassment for historians for a long time that this enlightened figure of Isaac Newton spent so much of his time working on alchemy, and they kind of tried to brush it away, to sort of shoo it away. But I think people are a little more comfortable nowadays recognizing that someone like Newton could still do really fundamental scientific work, but still be convinced that alchemy was the most important part of his legacy.
Well, that's wonderful. And, you know, Sam, we're getting ready to wrap things up because we're running out of time almost, but
okay.
I know this first book was your very first book that you've ever published, The Disappearing Spoon, what we're talking about today, and also a New York Times bestseller. Do you have a second book in you?
I do, actually. It will be out next summer. It's called The Violinist's Thumb. And the topic of it is the human genome, human genetics. And it has a lot of the same feel as The Disappearing Spoon, sort of funny, unusual, bizarre stories that we never would have anticipated are they're buried in our human genome, and that scientists have just been able to dig out in the past few years. So violinist thump next summer.
All right. Well, Sam, thank you so much for coming on again. That is Sam Keen. The book is The Disappearing Spoon. If you want to get more information in regards to this, you can go to his website, www.samkeen.com. That's S-A-M-K-E-A-N.com. Sam, would you like us to give an email address for you as well?
They can get in touch with me through the site. It's pretty easy there. So,
okay.
Yeah, and I would love to hear from people. I love hearing from them.
Well, Sam, I got to tell you, I thank you so much for coming on. I hope that this...
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I hope that this shows a lot of people out there that it probably wasn't a good idea to cut that science class when we were in high school, because there really is some very interesting things about science, and I love the fact that you are making it entertaining as well as still being very educational at the same time.
And
I think
accessible.
That's great.
Oh, that's good to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, and very
thank
accessible.
You.
So again,
okay, thank you.
Thank you. Everybody out there, we appreciate your letters. We appreciate the questions that you send in. And if you know of anyone who you think would be a perfect guest for our show, go to our website, www.answers4thefamilyblog.com. Have them send in a little bio, and we'll see if we can get them on. And until next week, we will hope that you will again be listening, and have a great week. Thank you.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.